issues like quantum gravity, the foundations of quantum theory, n categories, fancy math, and things like that. But over the years, the more I've learned about environmental issues, the more concerned I've become about them. And so I'm trying to shift my work in that direction, and I thought I'd tell you a little bit about why. So we live in an amazing period of time in the history of the Earth. Here's the graph of the population of humans on Earth over about the last 9,000 years. So definitely after the end of the last ice age, I guess basically here starting with the agricultural revolution. For a long time and a long time before that, the population of the Earth was small and very slowly changing. But with the birth of the Industrial Revolution and the ability to mine first coal and then other forms of carbon to power our civilization and the development of technology that could use that to replace human and animal labor, especially in the growing of crops, the population of Earth shot up. And so any attempt for us to survey the overall history of the Earth now is a bit like someone who's a cliff dweller trying to learn geography. We have a very strange, distorted view of history as a whole, and so we don't really even see how odd the present is. So we've been living in this time when industrial technology has taken off, and it's largely powered in a simple method, namely dig up stuff and burn it. And first that was coal, then petroleum, and now increasingly natural gas, and of course various new technologies like fracking allow us to dig up more and more carbon and burn it. There are, of course, other forms of energy that we have, nuclear, solar, and wind, but they're very small so far compared to this simple method. And so we're putting out a lot of carbon. So in 2011, which is the last year I could really easily grab data for, the average human on Earth put out 1.5 tons, metric tons, of carbon into the air. The average Canadian put out a lot more than that, about three times as much of that, 4.4 tons. United States, of course, even more. I guess Australia, even more than that. So worldwide, we put out a lot. We put out about 10 gigatons of carbon into the air that year. That sounds like a lot, but then you could say, well, but of course the atmosphere is huge, so maybe that's not such a big deal. Of course, the atmosphere is huge. It does have a lot of carbon dioxide in it, but it's not that much more huge. There are about 3,000 gigatons of carbon in the atmosphere. So that means that in just one year, we were able to increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by, I guess that's like a third of a percent. So that's the sort of change that's really dramatic by any sort of normal standards and adds up substantially over time. So we're really dramatically changing the biosphere right now. And you can see that if you look at a longer term graph of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. So it's gone up and down with the glacial cycles. The glacial cycles are correlated with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, warmth being correlated with more carbon dioxide. And so at the end of the last ice age, like about 15,000 years ago, the carbon dioxide went up from a little below 200 parts per million up to 250 or more, I guess more like 280. But then just when it would have presumably leveled off, it being a more or less typical ice age, the Industrial Revolution came along and boosted it up another significant notch, basically from around 280 to around 380, although by now it's 390. You can get a sense of how fast this changes, first of all, by seeing that that line there is basically vertical at the right hand, and second of all, by the fact that I can just look at this graph and see that it's a few years out of date, because now it's around 390. So So the overall problem with climate change is that it's happening so fast. So if anyone tells you, oh, come on, there are natural changes in the Earth's climate, you say, yes, but look at this graph here. This is a little bit different than that. And if anyone says, there have been times when the Earth has been much warmer than it is now, that's definitely true. You have to say, yes, but what's going to happen is we're going to reach much warmer times due to the greenhouse effect at an astoundingly rapid pace. And that means that people and also all the other life on Earth is going to have much less time to adapt than it has typically. There have been other periods of rapid climate change, and they haven't, in general, been nice to the larger species on Earth. You can see that the carbon dioxide is causing global warming due to the greenhouse effect by looking at this graph. So this is a bunch of different estimates of the Earth's average temperature since the end of the last ice age. So all those different wiggly colored lines show you that there's a lot of uncertainty in those estimates. They're done by lots of different methods and give lots of somewhat different results. But so that big black line is just an average of eight different estimates, and you really shouldn't take it too seriously. But what you can see that's not so questionable is that, again, there's a vertical line, which isn't exactly shown, at the very right hand of the graph, that the temperature of the Earth went up about 0.8 degrees in the last century. And so although there have been significant slow changes in the Earth's climate over the last 10,000 years or so, what's happening now is very different from that. Of course, if you go back further, the end of the Ice Age, there was rapid warming at that time too, and that's the kind of thing that makes the difference between Canada and most of northern part of the United States being covered with glaciers and what we have now. So we're doing something that will be similar in magnitude, because there's no reason to think this vertical line is going to stop right away, but it's starting from the warm state in the Earth's glacial cycle. So we're going to shoot out into some new unexplored territory that the Earth hasn't seen for the last 30 million years or so. So it's having lots of effects. One is that the Arctic is melting. Here's a graph of the minimum area of the Arctic that's covered with sea. So each year in the early fall, the amount of ice reaches its minimum point, and this is measured here in millions of square kilometers. And you have to notice this graph really does have zero at the bottom, at the horizontal axis there. So it's basically gone down by roughly a factor of two since 1979, which is really astounding. And people are busy now taking bets on when there will be no ice at all in the Arctic in summer, and a recent National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration report came out saying that different methods give different estimates, but they say probably before 2050 there'll be no ice in the Arctic in the summer. There will still be some in the winter. So what's happened is that we've left the geological period that's somewhat foolishly called the Holocene. So there are different periods like Pliocene, Pleistocene, Holocene. Holocene is just the name for the recent period of time, which is a very anthropocentric attitude. Basically, it's just the part of the Pleistocene, namely the period of time when there are ice age cycles, when we've been around. But whatever you want to call it, so it's really the Pleistocene that matters more to us, that ice age cycle I was showing you, it's done, okay? We're in a new geological epoch now. It's been dubbed the Anthropocene, and it's called that because now the Earth's climate and biosphere is rapidly changing due to humans. It's some unparalleled new episode, and it's not just a matter of temperature. You can also Geologists like to look at strata of rock because that's what they get, right? That's what they get to study when they're studying the ancient past. And they can see that the amount of soil deposited on the bottom of the oceans is about 10 times more now than it had been for a long time. The reason why is because while agriculture is designed to convert solar energy into plant mass that we can eat, in the process, a whole bunch of soil gets washed out and eroded into the ocean, going down muddy rivers like the Mississippi. And so we've upped the amount of erosion. Also, deforestation, not due to agriculture, causes this. We've upped the erosion level amazingly. So there will be some stratum of rock billions of years hence that future geologists, perhaps from some other civilization, can point to and say, oh, look, there's the Anthropocene. We see pieces of plastic in there. And that probably meant there was like an intelligent life form at that time. So we are dramatically changing things, but we're continuing to act as if nothing really new is happening. We're acting basically as if the Earth is essentially infinite, which Columbus and others have noticed that it's not. We're acting as if civilization is a negligible perturbation of the biosphere. So that basically, we can do whatever we want, and it really won't hurt the world as a whole. So basically, we should just maximize production of whatever we're interested in without any concern for the fact that that might have any side consequences. The whole subject of economics, as actually practiced by people who have any power, act that way, and they assume that the normal condition or the desirable condition of human affairs is exponential growth. So a certain percentage return on investments is regarded as necessary to keep the economy from collapsing or going into recession. So we're in this funny situation where, on the one hand, we know from physics that no quantity like the amount of energy we use can grow exponentially forever on a finite-sized planet. Because of the finiteness of the speed of light, even if we expand to other solar systems, we can't do it exponentially. Well, maybe if the space-time is negatively curved and we get out far enough, we'll be okay. But that'll take work. We're basically more or less trapped in a situation where on the Earth, you've got a finite amount of resources. In nearby space, at most, it's some kind of cubic growth law that you can aspire to. Yet the subject of economics occupies a different universe, which assumes that exponential growth is what we need all the time. And so if you act as if that's true, of course, you inevitably bring yourself to a point where it's no longer true. Things can exponentially grow until they hit some kind of ceiling. And if they don't slow down before they hit the ceiling, they'll hit the ceiling hard. So that's what we're in the process of starting to do now. We're starting to crash into the brick wall of reality, the fact that the planet is finite. We're doing that in lots of ways. Climate change is just one of those ways, but it's one of the most noticeable ways. There's been a nice bunch of work these days on what are called planetary boundaries, namely different limits that physical limits of our condition on the planet that we are beginning to nudge up against, the various ones that matter the most. For example, we're using up phosphorus a lot because we fertilize plants, it gets washed down into the ocean. So things like that. There are various of these limits that we're going to hit up against, and we need to think about them all because the real problem is not global warming. The problem is acting as if we're on an infinite planet. And global warming happens to be just the first sign that we're not, one of the first signs. So in some ways, I became more optimistic about this when I realized that we're inevitably going to solve this problem. There may be far fewer of us around by the time it's solved. That's the bad part. But if we don't muster the will to change our habits before things get really bad, they'll still do so late. We will still do so later, because then things will get significantly bad, and we'll just be forced to, more or less. So either way, no matter how eager we are to face reality or to avoid it, a transformation, which we're in the midst of, is inevitable. So the challenge is to do it gracefully. That's the way I think of it. I don't think of it as saying that we have to, the challenge is to face up to reality. Reality has a way of making you face up to it. The question is how. So what can we do? So to get a sense of the magnitude of this, which I don't think most people understand, let's look at this report that Pakala and Sokolow, an ecologist and an economist, put together in 2004. So they wanted to look for ways that you could use to hold carbon emissions constant for the next 50 years until 2054. So I should emphasize that holding carbon emissions constant does not constitute a solution to our problem. As long as you keep burning carbon at a constant amount, global warming will continue to get worse at an approximately constant rate. So holding it constant is not slamming on the brakes, which is what you should do when you're heading towards a cliff. It's just taking your foot off the accelerator, which is a first step. So with that caveat, it's still worth considering what's required, and they worked out that it would take approximately 7 what they called wedges, because they're shown as these skinny triangles or wedges on this picture here, and the idea is that each wedge would be a way to reduce carbon emissions more and more until you've reduced it by 1 gigaton per year by 2054. So this upper line here is a rough projection of what carbon emissions would do if we didn't take any particular action. And it would get us up to about 14 gigatons per year. And they wanted to say, what do we need to do by 2054 to keep it at about 7 gigatons per year? So what are some ways? So they came up with a list of ways. So, for example, for solar power. So, for solar power, you could replace 700 gigawatts of coal power by solar power. You need to replace it by more than 700 gigawatt peak production, because it doesn't shine. The sun doesn't shine all the time. So you'd actually need to replace it by a peak production of 200,000 gigawatts. But anyway, eliminate 700,000 gigawatts of coal power. So if we started doing that now and tried to get there by 2054, we'd need to multiply solar power by a factor of 30. So that's a significant increase. And when I first did this type of calculation a couple of years ago, I was pretty depressed by that. On the other hand, that's an 8% annual average growth rate. And right now, the rate is much more than that. Right now, the rate is 75% per year. So when I first gave this type of talk 2 years ago, part of why I was depressed is because we needed to multiply solar power by a factor of, I believe it was 80 at the time. So when I redid the talk this year, I saw it went down to a factor of 30 in 2 years, and that's quite impressive. Of course, you have to also think soberly about this. It's very easy to increase something at the rate of 75% of the year when there's very little of it. Whereas when you start getting to the point where solar power actually becomes significant, which it's really not in the overall scheme of things now, it's going to be a lot harder. No one would expect this growth rate to continue for that period of time. And even an 8% may become tough. Nonetheless, it's conceivable that we can do this, but I think we should definitely strive to do this, but you see, this will not solve the problem. This will give us one wedge, so it will solve 1/7 of the problem. So what else can we do? Well, we could replace the same amount of coal-fired power plants by wind. The wind is another renewable source of energy that doesn't have big doesn't have carbon emissions once you've built the machines, after you've built the machines. So starting now, that would require a 5% annual average growth rate of wind power. And right now that's 20%, but it's been slowing. Like 2 years ago, it was 25%. So there's a lot more wind power right now than solar, which is why we only need a 5% growth rate instead of an 8%. Or nuclear. We could do the same with nuclear power. This would require an annual growth rate of about just 1.6%. There's a lot more nuclear power, in other words, than either of those other two forms of power. I'm afraid I was unable to get statistics on what the growth rate is now, if at all. It is actually growing, despite some countries that are ceasing to use nuclear power. Some really big countries like China and India are continuing to invest in that. And so I suspect that this will actually play a major role in the overall business. What else? Conservation. So for example, automobiles. So they assumed that the number of cars would go up from 500 million worldwide in 2004 to 4 times that. That was before you do anything special. That was included in the top curve, the curve that's shooting up. But if you then somehow got everybody to drive half as much, not so easy, that would count as one wedge. Or, under the same assumptions, just make all the cars twice as efficient. However, without letting people drive more. Typically, increases in efficiency tend to cause people to use a resource a bit more. Or for buildings, a whole lot of energy gets used to heat homes, to some extent cool homes. If you were able to, and build other buildings, if you were able to cut carbon emissions by 25% in all buildings and electrical appliances, that would also give us a wedge. This is one of the easiest ones I think there is to do, because I'm sure we could do that if we put our mind to it at all. That's one we should, it's stupid not to do that, basically. So let's see. So I guess I've listed 6 wedges, and they list some more. They list a total of 15. But you need to do 7 of them. So as you can see, each one of these is a major activity, which is doable, but only doable if people really put their minds to it. And that's just the start. That buys us time until 2054, at which point we can actually start really cutting total carbon emissions. Total carbon emissions, get it less than it was in 2004. And unfortunately, that's not at all what's been going on. So Pakkala redid his report in 2011, and you can see the old green wedges were what he said we needed to do back in 2004. But by 2011, the number of wedges that we needed had gone up to 9 wedges because the projections of carbon use has actually gone up, and the carbon being, and even then holding it, we'd be holding it constant at some new higher level than what had originally been envisioned in 2004. So we need, as a civilization, to really pull together and tackle this problem, or we're going to face severe problems in the next couple of centuries. But we're not doing that now. We're going in the opposite direction. We're basically putting our foot on the accelerator when we need to actually really put it on the brakes. And there are basically 2 main ways to put it on the brakes. One is to stop burning carbon, or the other is to actively remove it from the air. There's, of course, a third way to cool the Earth, which is to make less sunlight hit the Earth. So geoengineering is a bunch of ideas for how to reflect sunlight. For example, putting sulfur dioxide in the upper atmosphere. That's actually a fairly cheap way to produce particles up in the upper atmosphere that reflect sunlight. Infinitely cheaper than silly ideas like putting mirrors in space, which, I mean, they might not eventually be silly, but they're silly now because it's much too expensive. But the problem with all these geoengineering ideas is that although they may keep, they quote, sorry, they're not quote, they may keep the planet cool, of course, there are risks associated with that. If the system stops working for a while, then all of a sudden the temperature is going to shoot up. And second of all, they don't stop the rise of carbon dioxide in the Earth's oceans, which is a second face to this carbon dioxide crisis we're facing. The increased carbon dioxide in the oceans is making the oceans more acidic, and it's already having significant effects on shellfish. So oyster production off some shores is starting to go due to acidity, and there are worse things than that that will happen when the oceans become extremely acidic. Basically, coral reefs will die, and certain kinds of very important organisms throughout the oceans will die. So I think for a full-fledged solution to this problem, you need to have there be less carbon dioxide in the air, and the only two basic approaches I can see are stop putting so much, put no more in, or take it out, or both. So the question is, what can folks like us do about this? It's, of course, not mainly us who are ideally suited to doing anything about this, because the real problems are sort of in the economic and political sphere. We need politicians who understand these problems, politicians who understand them well enough to fight enormously wealthy lobbies who don't want us to do anything about them. I should mention that various companies have already in their economic books the oil and coal that they're planning to dig up in the next decades. And so in some sense, in some economic sense, they're assuming that is going to happen. And that is, I think, a total of $27 trillion of carbon resources, which they already have on the books, which they haven't dug up yet. So you're fighting against a $27 trillion industry when you're trying to stop people from digging up that carbon and burning it. So that's why it's a political problem. It's also, of course, an economic problem in the sense that as long as our basic theory of economics assumes exponential growth and doesn't recognize the what's called the externality, the fact that that there's a huge price to carbon due to the fact that it's causing this problem, we're not gonna get an economic system that can face up to this problem. So these are really hard challenges. I think physicists can come up with ideas about those, but of course, this isn't sort of the core business of physics to deal with the messy ways of human beings. So one thing we can do is fly less. Now, I must say that with an embarrassed face here, because I flew here. I burnt a fifth of a ton of carbon burning here. So you may remember that in 2011, I said the average person put 1.5 tons of carbon into the air. I flew over here from California. And so I ate up a large portion of my ration just coming here. So that means that at least seven of you have to not make a trip one of you has to not make a trip to even me out. Seven of you have to not make a trip to completely make me feel like I'm a carbon-free kind of guy. But normally what I've been doing lately is giving this talk and trying to give other talks virtually, that is, give it by, for example, showing a video and answering questions on Skype and other things like that. And that seems to work. There's definitely lots of bugs in the technology. I warn you that if you ever try to do something like that, make sure you practice every aspect of it beforehand, because two different programs can work great separately. When you combine them, strange effects will happen. So we're certainly not set up for that kind of thing yet as a whole in academia, but I think we need to be. So I think we need to get very smart about conferences, I think we should be transferring more bits and fewer bodies. Moving kilograms of physicists back and forth is probably not really what a conference should be about. Of course, it will have force us to re-envision what a conference is like, but I think we need to do it eventually, and I think we might as well start now. Perimeter Institute is good in that they videotape a lot of talks, and that's the kind of thing that we can do more of. And the reason why I mention this is because the sort of academic elite of the world spends a lot of time flying around from place to place, burning huge amounts of carbon. And so the easiest way for you to cut your carbon emissions is not to put in better light bulbs or anything like that. Just go to one fewer conference that's far away, and that will completely outweigh anything else you could do, unless you have like a huge commute. So we need to do that. Another thing we need to do is to teach physics better than we do. Physics is, of course, relevant to the climate change issue, but also, and more generally, just the habits of thought that physicists have, if successfully taught to more students, would be the kind of thing that would help people realize that you can't have an exponentially growing economy on a finite-sized planet forever, and other things like that, suddenly more interesting things like how greenhouse effect works and so on. So the problem is that lots of studies have shown that, first of all, students' initial common sense intuitions are their main roadblock to learning physics. That we all have, before we learn a bit of physics, a whole bunch of intuitions about what happens when you move things around and how forces act on matter. And not all those intuitions are correct or match what we think of as the correct intuitions about force when we're talking about physics. And it's been shown that physics lectures don't change those intuitions very much. They've done studies where they ask people some very basic questions about, you know, like what happens if you have a rock on a string and the string breaks and other things like that before and after a freshman physics course at a good university. And they find that the amount of change in the answers to those questions is very small. What changes is the ability for people to work physics problems where they are solving some equations to calculate the answer to a question. But if you just ask them some question in words where the answer can be stated in simple words, it doesn't help very much, these lectures. And it's also been shown that this doesn't depend much on the quality of the instructor. It's not very teacher dependent. So if you say to yourself, well, yeah, that's true, because most physics teachers are no good, but I'm better than most of them. Well, first of all, of course, we better not have most of you saying that. Or, maybe everyone at the PI is great, but OK, we can't have most of the people in the world be better than average. But second of all, it's been shown that even the people who are better than average have very little effect through physics lectures in teaching some basic concepts of physics. And what's better is that something else has been shown to work. Classes that include students working and discussing things with their neighbors to solve these very simple kind of problems turns out to help a lot. Talk of mine is on my website, and maybe it'll be on the PI website afterwards. And if you click on any of these blue things, they're links, and you can see the statistics for these studies that show that. So there's a physics professor at Harvard named Eric Mazur. I guess he works on optics or photonics or something, but he also works on this issue, and he has materials called peer instruction, which are, some of it is software that makes it easier to do this kind of thing, although you don't, strictly speaking, need software to do it. But there are ways with modern software that you can really do things like ask a simple question to students, have them enter the answer using their tablets or whatever, and then say, okay, now talk about it with your neighbor for 2 minutes and then answer again. And they discover that what always happens is that performance increases from before and after a single conversation like that. And if you do this kind of thing repeatedly while you're talking, it actively engages the students and makes them think about things in a different way that just radically increases their ability. So why does this matter? Well, of course, teaching physics is important, but why does this matter with climate change? There are lots and lots of reasons, because everything about climate change has something or other to do with physics, but some of them are very basic. One of them is that ordinary folks have a lot of trouble with the difference between a stock, an amount of quantity, and a flow, that is, the time derivative of that amount of quantity. For example, whether force creates a velocity or an acceleration. There's a guy named Aristotle who failed the test on that one. If he had had pure instruction, he might have done better. Right? So, but this is an example of how you can be very intelligent and observant about the world and yet not notice this distinction that's crucial about a quantity and its time derivative. Another one is the difference between energy and power, or energy per time. If you read people talking about energy issues, you'll hear people often say, they'll often use watts as a measure of energy, or not distinguish between the energy per year made by something and the power. Between energy, of course, energy per year is power, but the energy and then the energy per year are different. And so it gums people up. Or, of course, if you go into economics, a lot of people really have never quite mastered the difference between the debt of a nation and versus its deficit, its time derivative. But the one that I'm most interested in right now has to do with global warming, has to do with carbon dioxide. The one thing a lot of people haven't absorbed yet is that for most practical purposes, meaning the next couple of centuries, the next 5 centuries or so, carbon dioxide, once you put it in the air, stays in there forever, unless we think of something to do. A third to a half of it will stay in there for over 1,000 years. So what it means is that reducing the amount of carbon dioxide you're putting into the air is just like moving a bit more slowly to the edge of a cliff. So if you're trying to stop rising carbon dioxide concentrations and thus rising temperatures, holding emissions constant is not good enough. It's really just as bad as it is now. Cutting them by 80% also is not good enough. Yes, it can buy you time, which is certainly a good idea, but it's not really a solution. It's sad to say, stopping them entirely is the best approximation to what counts as good enough for this problem. And surveys have shown that people don't know this. In 2007, a survey was done that showed that most MIT grad students didn't know this. They thought that solving global warming meant keeping carbon emissions constant, figuring out how to keep it from going up. But that's not what solving global warming really amounts to. Okay, now for something a little different. So you're a research physicist here, so I want to talk a little bit about that aspect of it all. So I think we need to create some new kinds of physics, lots of different aspects of this. Well, I say create the physics we need for life on a finite-sized planet. And if you already are having a lot of fun doing the kind of physics you're already doing, you may find this a little bit distasteful, having it being suggested that there's some other kind of physics that might help save civilization a little better. And I felt that way myself, of course, because I have a lot of fun thinking about N categories and all sorts of stuff that no one except me understands. And so it takes a kind of re-gearing of attitudes towards focusing on things that are a bit more earthly in scope, earthly in magnitude. But here are some. I'll list a few. There are lots. So if we could make solar power cheaper than fossil fuels, that would be incredible. That would do a lot. So right now, apparently, I'm no expert on this, so please don't ask me questions about this because I can't say too much about it. But I read that from people who I believe that quantum dot solar cells have an efficiency of 65% in being able to turn sunlight into electrical power, as opposed to just 31% for the ordinary silicon cells. If those could be made cheap enough, that would be really big news. In general, the problem with solar cells is that the ones with higher efficiencies tend to involve materials that are more exotic than silicon. But some people are trying to make quantum dot solar cells with silicon, as far as I can tell. And if you could do that, that would be huge. So people who are gung-ho about solar power keep on saying that any day now, solar power will become cheaper than fossil fuels. And once that happens, there'll be some kind of dramatic transition away from fossil fuels, one would hope anyway. But I don't think we're really there yet. And I think this is an area where quantum mechanics is actually incredibly important. So since a lot of you folks are experts on quantum mechanics, I thought I should mention this one. Or making wind power cheaper than fossil fuels would be a big deal. This is a different kind of problem as far as I can tell. A lot of the problem has to do with understanding turbulence at many different length scales, from the overall atmospheric scales, because wind coming in off of hot rock, I guess it's the afternoon, tends to have more turbulence in it, and it doesn't work so well for windmills. And windmills tend to create turbulence in their wake, as you can see in this picture here, that makes the ones behind them not do so well, all the way down to turbulence issues on the blade of the windmill itself, the actual functioning of the turbine and how it cuts through the air. And it turns out that the United States, we have a slightly messed up system where part of the game of wind power is predicting ahead of time how much power you're going to make. It's not the same way in the EU. I don't know what it is in Canada, the economics of this. But in the United States, if a wind farm's predicted power generation is off by 1%, it can cost them millions of dollars. So they're spending a lot of work trying to get good at understanding and predicting turbulence. And even if it weren't for the messed up economic incentives, understanding the Navier-Stokes equations, which govern fluid flow, would be incredibly important, not just for wind power, but also for climate forecasting. One amazing thing is there's a $1 million prize to prove that the Navier-Stokes equations have solutions. No one knows that these equations have solutions for all time, given smooth initial data. So if you are mathematicians, or if some of you are of the mathematical physics ilk, you could think about those kind of things. So right now, we simulate fluid flow down to a certain grid level, and then we need to make some assumptions about what's happening at the smaller, shorter distance scales. And that's the biggest source of uncertainty in things like weather prediction. No one really has any way to justify any one assumption as, in any rigorous way, as being better than the other, because we don't even know that the equations that we're trying to simulate really have solutions. So that's an interesting theoretical problem. Another is to make nuclear power cheaper and safer. Now, nuclear power is a very divisive issue. So if you hate nuclear power and nothing is going to change your mind, just don't listen to this slide and just enjoy the rest of my talk, the stuff before and after it. But according to James Hansen, who's one of the United States' top climate scientists, nuclear power has already saved 1.8 million lives through the course of, well, here it's starting from the 1970s, because of what it replaces, coal. So this is not counting any benefits having to do with the global warming, which you could also try to add in but that would be much harder to estimate. This is just taking into account the fact that coal is extremely bad for people's health, the pollution produced by coal power plants. So I think actually that, nuclear power is something we really have to take seriously and go ahead with. And what we should do is not try to get rid of it, but try to make it better. So for example, in Fukushima, the idea of storing partially used radioactive materials in a tank of water that's on the second story of a building that needs electric power constantly to keep the tank from, draining and, the fuel from melting down, that's just a stupid idea. There's such a thing as passive safety, which means you set up your machines in a way such that if you pull out the plug and leave, the machine will just cool down or stay at a constant temperature and just sit there and not do anything. It's possible to design nuclear plants in that way. Thorium reactors are very interesting, and India is pursuing thorium reactors. They're interesting, first of all, because there's a lot of thorium, and second of all, because it's harder, although I guess not impossible, to make nuclear weapons starting from thorium. And for the more ambitious of you out there, don't forget fusion. There is this substance, deuterium, that we have huge amounts of in the oceans, which if we could only figure out how to fuse it in a commercially viable way, our carbon-free energy problems would be over with. More generally, physicists should think outside of the box. So I've listed some things for you to do, but you should really not mainly focus on the things that I told you. You should think about the things that, you're thinking of that are none of the things that people have thought of before, because we definitely need a lot of this type of thinking to tackle this problem. You will find that when people face the gravity of this problem, they instantly come up with three or four ideas, which are almost always a little bit stupid in one way or another. The problem of climate change so far doesn't seem to admit any kind of silver bullet solution, one thing that can be done that will solve the problem. That's why this idea of wedges, of breaking up the problem into bite-sized pieces, is so important. So I don't promise you that if you think about this hard for a few days, you'll figure out a solution that's going to be the right one that no one's thought of before. But I think if we have enough people trying to do this and then listening to the corrections that other people make, we'll come up with some ideas that no one has now. And I want to emphasize there's lots of room for all sorts of different types of work. And since I'm very mathematical and very theoretical, it's very hard for me to turn my attention towards something like designing a better nuclear power plant or anything like that. Some of you probably know what I mean. There's some kinds of people who just like to think about things that are like floating up in the air and don't necessarily do well at trying to solve practical problems directly. So I'm trying to do the best that I can, given my personality, by working on a theory of networks. And I'm intrigued by the idea that we can try to understand ecosystems and the complex kind of problems we're facing here in understanding the Earth by understanding networks better. There are many different kinds of networks. There are food webs in ecology. There's the flow of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen through the ecosystem, various cycles. There are gene regulatory networks. There are models of predator-prey interactions, and so on. And one thing I noticed is that a large class of these models called stochastic Petri nets, you can apply the same kind of math that works in quantum field theory to these. So this here is a little Feynman diagram showing an interaction between rabbits and wolves, somewhat idealized here, but just to get the flavor of the idea across. And I discovered that if you take the normal technology of quantum field theory, annihilation and creation operators, coherent states, and so on, and you use positive real numbers instead of complex numbers, and interpret those as relative probabilities instead of amplitudes, a whole bunch of the same stuff works. I was really amazed to discover that the canonical commutation relations for creation and annihilation operators really is right to describe the interaction of classical, even macroscopic, objects that are identical, like wolves, if you don't know wolves personally, and that the non-commutativity of those operators is actually suited to these systems, even though they don't have Bose-Einstein statistics. So that's an idea of taking some mathematical technology that you know from your work on physics and transposing it over to a realm that may turn out to be useful in something more like biology, and hence perhaps more relevant to these ecological problems. And I guess I'll leave off by saying that I've started this thing called the Azimuth Project, which has a blog called Azimuth, and a bunch of people who are working on these kind of things, who are basically not mainly professional climate scientists, but different kinds of mathematicians, physicists, and computer programmers who are interested in spending some of their time dealing with these environmental problems. And so if you're interested, you can click on this link or just type Azimuth Buys or something like that, and you'll find out about it. Okay, thanks.
Okay, we like to give students the first chance to ask questions. So any students want to start us off?
Come on, students. Interactive peer instruction. You have to interact.
So I just wanted to ask, like, you mentioned that one thing that we can do is if we don't, like, stop, like, the carbon emissions, we can try to remove them. What sort of thing that you can do in a large scale in terms of, like, removing carbon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very hard problem to do it on the necessary scale. So I mainly mention it for logical completeness rather than because I think that that's the most practical approach. So it's easiest to remove carbon dioxide when there's a lot of it somewhere. So the idea of building carbon-burning plants where the carbon dioxide gets filtered out from the exhaust, of course, that's not decreasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, but it's keeping it from increasing. So that's already in development. So in China, they have some coal-burning plants that would have no carbon emissions. And so what they do is they basically manage to get the carbon dioxide separated and compress it into a liquid form and then press it down a well down into rocks. So that's probably the most practical form of carbon sequestration that I know of now. But another really interesting one is to harness the power of plants, because plants, of course, spend their lives taking carbon dioxide out of the air, and there are lots of them. So in a way, it's stupid to try to start from scratch. We should try to use them. And so Gregory Benford, the science fiction author who's very interested in these issues, he has written some scientific papers on the idea of taking agricultural waste material. So when in a developed country, when you harvest something like corn, there's lots of corn stalks and stuff left. And in a developed country, you don't just leave those lying around. What they do right now is they remove them all and they put them somewhere. But if you put them in bins at the bottom of the ocean, then the carbon is sequestered for a fairly long period of time. And so he's done some experiments where he's actually done that with bins of agricultural material. And the question is, how fast does it rot, and then how fast does the carbon dioxide get back up to the atmosphere? But it seems like it has a chance of working. Another thing that people have looked at a lot is, but need to look at more, is what's called iron ocean fertilization. So putting iron I forget what it is, some iron compound, some iron oxide, ferric or ferrous, I forget which, into the ocean, because it turns out that plant growth of algae in the ocean, is largely limited by the availability of iron there. So the hope is that if you fertilize the ocean, you'll get a bloom of algae that will suck up a lot of carbon dioxide through photosynthesis. And then the hard part is you want the algae to die and then to fall down to the bottom of the ocean, taking the carbon with them before, for example, they get eaten by other things that would keep it in the biosphere. And so they've done, I guess, about two or three experiments where they've put large amounts of iron in patches of the ocean. And in two of those experiments, I forget if I have the numbers exactly right, but in about two of those experiments, it did not take down a whole bunch of carbon. But in a third experiment that happened more recently, it did. So it may depend on how you do it, on the details, how you do it. Those were sort of pretty large but small scale experiments, but you could imagine scaling them up. And then, of course, you'd have to worry about the effects, of course, because that's going to have effects on the biosphere, too.
Are there student questions?
I suppose that if you would take a random person, for example, on the street and ask them what their opinion is on what they think of global warming and the issue is, that they probably wouldn't know what's going on. In a sense, like they maybe wouldn't know whether it's increasing, whether it's getting worse or not, or whether it's human influence or not. And I was wondering, what do you think is the reason for that? Is it related to you saying that the common public doesn't know enough physics, or is it the news, the media coverage of it, etc.? And how important do you think is to change that general view, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, I think the general view depends a lot from country to country, from what I've read. I don't think that physics education is the main thing, because people have correct beliefs about a lot of scientific issues, other scientific issues, where they don't know the theory in detail. It's just that the conventional wisdom happens to be correct in some of those other issues. So in the case of climate change, I mean, there are extremely well-funded, influential lobbies of people trying to cast doubt on everything, on whether climate change exists, on whether it's caused by people, and whether it has bad effects. And that surely plays some role. A lot of people are trying to figure out ways to change that situation. Yeah, so in some sense, that's the most important political aspect of this. You can't really expect politicians to come out in front of the populace on this issue, right? If no one else thinks that global warming is a serious problem, because almost any solution to the problem isn't going to involve some kind of sacrifice or unpleasantness, no politician is going to be too eager to pursue it. So in my more somber moments, I think that what we are going to have is a number of storms and other kind of weather crises that will, weather-related issues like the fires in Russia and so on, that will convince people that the climate is changing and that there really is something strange going on, because seeing is believing to some extent. I would like to have things change faster than that, but that may be the way it actually goes.
Maybe we'll open it to questions from everybody, and of course, students can continue to ask questions.
So you spoke about the current economic models being not consistent with what the Earth can support. Are you aware of work in the economic sphere which is more in line with the realistics, with reality?
Yes, there is. There's a lot of different work along those lines. There's a organization called the, I can't remember if it's a center or what, the Organization for Non-Autistic Economics. This is, I guess, when autistic was an acceptable, still an acceptable insult. But they're basically trying to trying to fix a lot of assumptions about economics. You can look up their website. There's a lot of really interesting work on better indicators of progress, because the gross domestic product, that statistic, that innately biases you towards thinking of certain things as good. So for example, I could increase the GDP by going out, buying a bunch of paper, and setting it on fire. That counts as improving the economy, right, according to the GDP statistic. So there are people who've been trying to amend that by taking into account the environmental costs, and there's also have been people trying to come up with what they call happiness indicators, that is, trying to actually measure happiness. There's been a whole lot of work in psychology on trying to understand happiness, because if you think very carefully about economics, you see that economics as currently largely practiced is based on this concept of utility. People are trying to maximize utility, which is a word that means something like happiness, but you're like too embarrassed to say the word happiness. And yet people don't really know very much about what makes people happy. And I must admit, in fact, we don't even really know for sure that people actually want to be happy. They don't necessarily actually do what makes them happy in every circumstance. So a lot of the basic assumptions of economics are sort of mysterious, and people are beginning to work on them. But of course, the problem is that those people aren't mainly bankers, right? So the problem is that economics is a science that is severely warped by the fact that it's applied in ways that require what those people are doing be justified. And so the hard part, it seems to me, is not to improve economics, but to get the improved economics to make any difference.
John, since we're good at out-of-the-box thinking, can I throw an out-of-the-box question at you?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, which is, supposing that this problem is solved gracefully.
Okay, wow.
What would the civilization look like as a consequence? And let me ask a question. So, for example, there might have been a time when people worried about encroaching on land use.
Approaching what?
Encroaching on land use. I mean, when agriculture was invented,
uh-huh,
people might have said, oh my God, we're beginning to change the way that the land is used. And now we live in a regime quite comfortably in which a high proportion of the surface of the earth is controlled by human beings growing crops and so forth for our benefit. And that's stable.
I wish it were stable, but yeah,
well,
okay.
But you know what I mean? It's
yeah,
So when you poo-poo geoengineering, somebody might come back and say, but the end point has to be some form of geoengineering, because we want a world with a lot of people living at a high standard of living, pushing up as far as we can go without destroying the climate. So can you envision how that might be done without geoengineering?
The one assumption I question most there is this large number of people. So the population is supposed to keep going up till around 2050, and then United Nations predicts it actually will start decreasing, because it turns out that in all really developed countries with high standards of living, eventually eventually the birth rate drops below the replacement rate. And so there are all sorts of countries like Japan and parts of Europe and Singapore, where I've been spending time, where the government is worried about the population going down, which seems crazy to me. But of course, it's related to the fact that they would think that the GDP should go up. So it's good to have more people, because that makes the GDP go up, which seems stupid. But so I think, in fact, it's possible that if we manage to somehow keep things from going too bad for long enough for really large portions of the Earth to become pretty highly developed in a way sort of similar to Europe and America, the population may go down to the point where things are going to be able to be a lot, these problems are going to be a lot easier to deal with. So I think of this as a transitional problem rather than a long-run problem. I don't think the world would be bad with a dramatically smaller population as long as we got there in some way that wasn't, you know, massive famines and so on.
So would it be, is anybody working on that, on a model of that, or would it be useful to work on
I think that would be useful to work on. So I don't know how much the demographers have connected up to the climate change people. It's not going to happen fast enough. The population decreases aren't going to happen fast enough if we just like follow the United Nations estimate and say, okay, that's the way it is. We'll just wait and the problem will go away. It's not fast enough to make that happen. But if we could handle things for like the next 100 years, then things might actually be a lot easier after that because of decreased population and better, you know, better technology in a lot of ways. So I think of this as a bottleneck type problem and a question of whether we're going to get to the end of the bottle in a nice way or in a really nasty way.
Next question.
You mentioned before in passing that warming is not the only problem that we're running up against. I think you mentioned phosphorus depletion.
Yeah, there's
an. Can you make a short list or sort of expand on what if some of the other problems are that we also should be thinking about?
Yeah, I wish I think I haven't figured out. I just showed up today. I'm not connected to the internet here, but there's a really nice list which I don't have memorized. Let me try to think of some of the. Sorry, I'm not necessarily going to spit off all seven of them. sorry, I'm blanking out. Well, okay, ocean acidification is one, but I guess I was trying to lump that in with global warming as two faces of the carbon dioxide problem. I'm sorry, I'm blanking out besides those.
Nitrogen loss, land use change. The phosphorus was one, sorry for everybody, I'm just adding a couple. It's a biodiversity loss, phosphorus, nitrogen cycle, land use change, ocean acidification, and a couple others.
Yeah, so land use change and thanks a lot for saving me. I knew all those, but I just like blanked out. So biodiversity loss is very closely related to land use change. And so that's why I don't really agree with Lee about having reached a stable state in terms of, sorry? Well, okay, so you provoked me and now I'm responding. especially in lots of poor jungly countries, they're really busily chopping down large amounts of rainforest and mainly for the purposes of agriculture, sometimes even for growing biofuels. And that's causing a biodiversity problem because that's where a lot of the biodiversity is. So I think of those two as another pair. And the nitrogen and the phosphorus are both about using lots of commercial fertilizer for our agriculture and then letting it all wash into the ocean. So you could maybe say that there are mainly three different things going on.
So you want to share your opinion on the dirty Canadian tar sand?
Sorry?
What's your opinion on the dirty Canadian tar sand?
The what? Sorry, I didn't.
The tar sands.
Oh, they should stay where they are. As long as people don't realize that we have to stop emitting carbon, then there are going to be lots of people saying, "Oh, good, we can increase, you know, help our economy by digging up stuff and burning it." And, you know, so you need a tax on carbon that will stop that, or something like that.
definitely agree with you, but say if we cannot convince the government to do that, is it better to sell it to China or to the US?
I haven't thought much about that. I haven't thought much about who you want to let burn your carbon if you're going to burn it. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, I think the answer is it doesn't matter. If somebody's burning it, then you know somebody else is burning something else. So it's not.
An interesting fact is that United States carbon emissions have been going down for the last 10 years, which really surprised me when I first heard about it. But one of the reasons was the recession, but that lasted for a fairly short while. It's more than that. Seems that one other reason, there are a lot of reasons, but one other reason is that more and more manufacturing is being done in China. And the same kind of thing affects Europe. So they do this carbon bookkeeping, but it does not include the goods that they buy that are made in China. So offshoring of carbon emissions is a problem, not because it's bad that people are making things in China, but because it's not necessarily being taken into account by other countries. So they say, oh, we're being so virtuous. Meanwhile, they're just doing all the manufacture somewhere else.
Other questions? Okay. Let's start on this side.
So you mentioned that you know the problem is a bottleneck, and one thing we could do is solve various scientific problems that could help. I wonder if another activity our community could be involved with is sort of trying to figure out how to increase the rate of scientific progress. So there's various ideas about you know open science and just sort of changing the social institution of science to make sure that progress happens faster. So given that you blog a lot, I wonder if you had an opinion on the role of that for this problem.
Yeah, I'm really trying to work on that side of things. So to me, just making science progress faster is certainly not enough of a solution, because you could also make science progress faster and basically just wind up doing more of business as usual. So I don't think of that by itself as a solution. But one thing I think is very important is open access to scientific information, because right now, almost all the serious research on climate science issues, for example, is behind paywalls. It's in journals that the public can't read. And so we're in a situation where bloggers who are climate change skeptics can attract huge followings, and their material is easy to access, whereas the climate scientists who actually study the subject basically bury their information in these forms where no one can get at it. And I think that they, for example, they're not very good about using something like the archive or anything like that. So I've been working with a friend, Chris Lee, who's head of bioinformatics at UCLA, and we're just about to announce something we call the Selected Papers Network, which is a way to discuss and eventually perhaps referee papers that's fully open access and available. And so something like this, if done right, and which means getting it to catch on and setting up a bunch of organizations, could basically manage to get rid of the current paywall journal type system, which I think we really need to do. And so that's another big challenge, but I'm very interested in that.
Okay. So carrying on from Rob's question, it seems if we're going to solve this problem gracefully, we need lots of different people with lots of different skill sets in order to actually implement a solution.
Yeah.
It's like on one hand we have scientists and physicists trying to actually find a solution, but we'll also need people who have the skill set of going and lobbying politicians, convincing them and trying to get resources off them so that we can actually implement a solution if one is found. So I was wondering, is the Azimuth project, is that primarily concerned with scientists and physicists and trying to find a solution, or does that combine both of those things and trying to send physicists and scientists who understand the problem to like governments to try and convince them to give them resources in order to try and solve it?
Uh-huh. Um, The main limitations of the Azimuth project is that I'm really terrible at anything like managing, and I somehow would really prefer it if other people got more involved in the Azimuth project and would do it much better than I'm doing. But what the goal of it is to organize activities related to climate change, and just due to who I am, that tends to focus in on mathematics and physics, because those are the people who know who I am and will pay attention if I say anything, which is really a limitation. It's not really not what I would have done if I could change my personality, right? I would love it if some people from different backgrounds got involved and started pulling communities together, because we need something like that. I'm not sure I'm the right person to be doing it. That's the sad thing about it.
So one of your points was that we have to dramatically rethink economy, and I think one step to do so would be to dramatically rethink our financial system, because economy.
Sorry, we can what?
Our financial system. Because
it's been doing its pretty good job of it weakening itself, yeah. But
the exponential growth comes from the exponential growth of the debts of companies or of the states, or because of interest rates. But first of all, do you agree with this point, or do you think there?
I don't think they're ever going to sell anything by saying we need to weaken the economy. You have to say it some other way, no matter what you're thinking. You can't say that. I thought he said weaken. Okay, we need to rethink it. I thought he said we need to weaken the financial system. That's why I was saying that the financial system was weakening itself.
I would be also okay with weakening to some extent.
So what your question was now, what do I agree that we need to rethink the financial system? Yes, certainly I agree with that. Yes, the whole idea that it's difficult to do, because you right now it's set up that you'd like to be able to earn a fixed percent return so that you can retire. You know, it's not just big bad guys who want to do that. So that means that there are a whole bunch of people running around trying to say that this investing in this will give you a high percentage return. And of course, in the financial crisis, it reached the point where people were doing any crazy thing to make it seem as if it would give that high return, and then it sort of crashed temporarily. But somehow we actually need to think much harder about this to make it be that anything that's increasing exponentially has to be something that's in some sense purely virtual, not real in the sense of using any more physical quantity. And so there's interesting questions about how much of an economy can be made virtual. You know, can we be becoming exponentially happier without anything outwardly changing that much? Those are really interesting and tricky questions.
Okay, on the notion of exponential increase in happiness, I think that's maybe a good point to stop. So let's thank John again.
Okay, thanks.